Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from The Oldie. Welcome to the first in a series of six interviews with friends of The Oldie. It seemed appropriate, given the current times, that my first guest should be a comedian. But specifically, someone who is known and loved by us all, the great Barry Cryer, who I caught up with from a social distance in his North London home for a spoonful or two of his trademark humour, as we undertook an unashamed trip down memory lane, but first reminisced about that famed and much-loved monthly gastronomic feature, the Oldie Lunch.
I stood up to do my usual stench, and I said to the audience, before I start, I'd like to read a tribute to our editor, Harry Mount. And it was a good flutter of applause, and Harry's sitting there thinking, what's this all about? So I started reading. I said, Harry Mount, an editor much admired by his peers. As an editor, this man has had a unique career with the amount of information and skill he... And I stopped and looked at Harry and said, I'm sorry, Harry, I can't read your writing. A woman sees in the window a beautiful blue and gold parrot. And she thinks, oh, gorgeous. So she goes in and says to the man, how much? He said, 20 quid, 20 pounds. She said, but he's beautiful. He said, well, I've got to be honest with you. He's got form, he's got history. He's got quite an extensive vocabulary. And he was in a brothel. And she said, well, I'll take a chance on that. And bought the parrot, took it back to her flat. Took the cover off, and the parrot looked round and said, new place, very nice. And the two daughters walked in, and the parrot said, new place, new girls, very nice indeed. And her husband walked in, and the parrot said, hello, Keith. I'm BA English failed of Leeds University, and a year or so ago they made me Honorary Doctor of Arts, and Melvin Bragg gave me this Honorary Doctorate. And then I was asked to speak, and I faced this huge audience in Leeds and said, you're looking at a failure. Get some rejection in early in your life and then move on. And so I failed. I was out. So I got one or two real jobs in Leeds, the highways department and everything. And I'd been in the student charity show, the Rag Review at the Old Empire Theatre. And they were doing another one the following year, but Jeff Green, I think is his name, he was poorly or something and he couldn't do it. They got me back to produce it and be in it. I wasn't even at the university by then. And a guy came up to Leeds to see somebody, not me, and he saw me on the stage telling jokes and offered me work. Now, how did that happen? I was in the right place at the right time.
That's serendipity, I suppose, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. It is fair to say, I think, literally started from the bottom up when you were at the Windmill Theatre doing six shows a day, 6 days a week, yeah, between the two new acts.
And you did 12:15 was the first show. And I, conveyor belt auditions in the morning, wheel them on, wheel them off. And the man before me had a load of props, a very elaborate act, and started his act, and the boy said, thank you. And I thought, oh, bless his heart. Taking all that preparation. Next! So I went on, told some jokes, sang a song. This was Vivian Van Damme, the great man, sitting there. Do you know any more jokes? Well, yes, told. Do you know another song? Yeah, but I haven't got any music. Ronnie will busk for you. That was Ronnie Bridges, the pianist who became a friend. So I sang another song. Thank you. Thought, well, that's it. Then a man came on the stage who also became a friend called John Law. He said, dressing room 12A. I said, sorry, you've got the job. I was on the stage at 20 past 12. I couldn't believe what was happening, doing my 12 minutes or whatever. And the old man had me in his office between every show that day. He changed my act. That joke's very good. You tell it too early, tell it a bit later. Here's one you could do. Amazing man. And then there was a message, someone at the stage door. I thought, who knows I'm here? It was the man who auditioned before me, who lasted about 3 minutes. He said, oh, I heard he got the job. Well done. Isn't that lovely? And one of my first jobs, my hometown, City Varieties Theatre, Leeds, where they used to do the good old days programme. And, of course, television had moved in. The theatres were having a rough time, the variety theatres, so they went for strippers, and then they lost the family audience. It was a weird era. I was bottom of the bill with strippers. Living at home, my dad had died when I was young. My brother was away in the Merchant Navy. It was just me and my mum, and I thought, well, there's no way a decent woman is coming to see me in the City Varieties. She never asked. I got home every night for supper, and she never asked how it had gone, and I thought, okay, okay. On the Saturday, there was a matinee, and I went in, and the woman in the box office said, here, you, was that your mother last night? I said, was what my mother last night? My mother was quite small. Small woman with a rain hat on came up and said, what time's Barry Cryer on? And she said, I sort of knew it was your mother. She said, about 10 minutes, love. Can I buy a ticket? She said, no, you can't. You're going in. And the commissionaire, another world, isn't it, showed my mother in, showed her a seat. She didn't sit down. She stood at the back, watched me, and fled into the night. So I got home that Saturday night. I said, you came last night, didn't you? Yes, yes. And I'm waiting for her opinion. The suit looked nice. That was it. I had a half-baked idea of being a journalist, a writer, but radio was king. There was no television when you were growing up in the war. So it was Tommy Handley and Arthur Askey. Oh, and the great Max Miller was very, saucy, cheeky man. He played Leeds. This was amazing. Max Miller in Leeds at the Empire Theatre. My mother took me to see him. I thought, this is interesting. And I met him later years, Max Marisa. I aim at the women, and then you've got the men. And he was the naughty boy with the twinkling. My mother was sitting there twinkling away, loving it. All this double entendre and suggestive stuff. And then I did a radio show some years late. Well, not, yes. Midday Music Hall, what it says on the tin, a live radio show. And it was done in theatre, but they were using dressing rooms. I thought, dressing rooms for a radio show. Max Miller wore his full stage costume, and I was in the same dressing room. I was in awe, you know. Can't work in ordinary clothes, son. So we did the run-through, because we're all there. What's Miller going to do? Bill Worsley, I remember the producer's name, sitting there, the Paris Studios, Lower Regent Street, and Max has got scribble on a bit of paper, and he does his act, which was only about a radio show, about 5 or 10 minutes. But he told this joke. In the old days, when buses had conductresses and conductors, this bus breaks down. Driver says to the conductor, start ring the garage, I'll fix this. He's down the front with his head under the bonnet. 10 minutes go by, passengers are getting restless. Conductors went down to him and said, you want a screwdriver? He said, no, we're 10 minutes late already. Now then.
You talk a lot about radio. Is that where your first home is?
Oh, yes, yeah. But, I mean, my experience was all live to start with, you know. I didn't do much variety. I only played one of the top variety theatres, Sheffield Empire, so I was home every night. And that was a comedian called Jimmy Wheeler, who took me under his wing after the band call. We went off to the pub, and I'd heard about him drinking. And he had a half and bought me a pint. I thought, but I've heard he's a drinker. But he came to life when he drank the half. And then we did 2 shows a night, you know, twice nightly. And that night he wandered off his act and praised our brave boys in Cyprus. And the conductor, the pits, looking up, going, what's happening? Jimmy Edwards, who I got to know very well. We shared a birthday.
He was, of course, the big wacko, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he was gay. Jimmy installed his boyfriend, an Australian lifeguard, in a flat near Victoria. He lived down in Fletchling, down there, Jimmy. And it was a horrible era. Your gay mates didn't come out because they'd have been ruined. They'd probably gone to prison. And later on, I was writing and being in the show was at Danny LaRue's club.
Yes.
And Jimmy got evicted one night. He was heckling the show from the moment it started. And you thought, that's interesting. And then Danny did a show for 2 years at the Palace Theatre. Dick Vosburgh and I wrote it. Brian Blackburn did the songs. Jimmy was in every other night, sitting in Danny's dressing room, chatting.
Danny LaRue was, of course, a great star of stage. What are your fondest memories of Danny?
There are many. Paul O'Grady said, years later, he said, Danny was the man who opened the door. If you were a drag act, Dan hated the word drag for some reason, but he said you were a cellar or a back room of a pub. He said Danny was a theatre star, he was on television. He said he broke the mould. He was the drag act, the female impersonator. But in those days, Danny would come on looking sensational. You couldn't believe what you were looking at. But his opening line was, "Watch your mate." So the men could laugh. It's a man dressed up, the women admire in the front. It's sad looking back that he felt he had to, it was funny, but he had to do it, "Watch your mate." And he didn't come out until Jack Hanson, his partner, died.
Yeah.
And then he came out quite openly and said, you know, the game's all that ridiculous, it's over and I'm out, you know. It was very moving.
Mm. You always like to write with a partner.
I wrote nightclub shows on my own, but ever afterwards, invariably work with a partner. But it's great because you ding-dong it between yourselves. And if you were solo writer, you know, him and the great Johnny Spate wrote alone, and I think they just wore themselves out, you know.
Yeah.
It helps enormously if you're writing with a partner.
Do you, for a pattern when you're doing that, do you work 9 to 5, or do you say, right, we'll come and do 3 hours an hour?
There wasn't one. You work the hours it needed.
Yeah.
Sometimes you'd finish by lunchtime and you're off to the pub. And John Cooper Clarke, he said, in this age of technology and text and email and computers, he said, nothing's changed, he said. You can make a living with a pen and a bit of paper. If you've got a pen and a bit of paper, you're in business. You could do it.
If you got stuck and you had the block, what was your way around that?
Well, your way around it was working with a partner. But the great joke about writers having a block, I remember this one. I used to do it in my show. I'd say, I once had a complete block writing a script and couldn't think of this word. Tried to think of this word for 2 weeks and then I thought, fortnight, that's it.
From 1 minute you're with Dick Emery, the next minute with Kenny Everett, you're with Eric and Ernie or Tommy Cooper. You must presumably have to then think in terms of the character all the time, and that must be very hard to differentiate.
Well, I used to say, like a tailor making suits, you've got to fit who you've got to hear their voice and see them in your head. And when John and I were writing for Eric and Ernie, there's a sitter and a walker. I've talked a lot of other writers about this. I'd be sitting at the table with a typewriter or scribbling, and John would be walking around the room being Eric Morecambe, twiddling his glasses. You've got to hear them. You could write the same routine for two comedians, and it'd be totally different.
And with Tommy Cooper, a lot more physical, a lot more slapstick, a great presence on stage. I mean, that must seem quite difficult when you're coming to stage from someone quite technical, like, say, Dave Allen or Dick Emery, where I presume the devil was in the detail.
Yeah, I do miss silly. Eric and Ernie were two grown men being silly. Tommy Cooper was a brilliant magician in a magic circle, and I mean, being silly. And he was an absolute one-off, because the audience laughed when he came on. And sometimes he didn't come on and you heard him, you know this, he's trapped in the dressing room, the lock's jammed or something, and he was just a one-off. Years ago, he played the Golden Garter Club in Manchester, and Eric Morecambe told me, he said there were 3 or 4 of us in the area at the same time, a young Des O'Connor and people. So he said, I rang round and we got about 6 of us together, we'd all go and see Tommy at the Golden Garter on Friday night, whatever. And Tom was on late, and he came on late that night. And there's three or four tables of them. And they said, as usual, he was hilarious. But Eric said, I checked it out. It hadn't been set up. In the middle of Tom's act, a waiter walked right in front of him and dropped a tray of glasses with a crash. And he said, four tables leaned forward. What's Tom going to say? And he said, Tommy looked down and said, that's nice. And got an enormous laugh. And Eric said, that's quite brilliant. Tommy wasn't thinking, what's a great funny line I can do? What's an actual Tommy Cooper like? That's nice.
Your involvement with David Frost, do you think that sort of put you on the superhighway to working with all the greats?
Every door opened if you were a Frost writer. You could have been rubbish.
Yeah.
But everybody wanted to know you if you were a Frost writer.
And that took you across the States to Bob Hope and a great character there.
I called him a practicing catalyst. He was brilliant with people, Frosty. Mm. And Graham Chapman, who wrote with John Cleese, obviously. But Frosty had spotted Graham and I had become mates. There was a whole gang of us. And he put us together writing. John Cleese used to say, you're being unfaithful to me with Graham. And we wrote sitcoms for Ronnie Corbett and everything, Graham Chapman and I, and that was Frost. He saw something there. And Graham and I wrote about 50 scripts together in the finish. But he and I had never thought of writing together. Frost was amazing like that. And of course he became massive and helped to bring down Richard Nixon and all that, you know. And the joke at the time was he had an open-top convertible car. And they said, when it starts raining, Frosty presses a button on the dashboard and it stops raining.
Do you miss the great days of comedy, the 70s and 80s? Where
I
we
don't
had
say we were better, I say we were different.
Yeah,
we were more orthodox. You did your jokes and you sang a song to finish. Now it's the me generation. The men and women talk about themselves, their observations on life. And there's some brilliant performers now. There are in every generation. And Paul Merton said to me once, he said, there's a lack of individuality. You remember something somebody did and you think, which one was that? Yeah. I saw four women one night live at the Apollo and there's some lovely stuff they did, but I couldn't remember which one of them said it.
With Humphrey Richardson, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue. It always seems to be having great fun. Do you miss
Well, there's no... We're doing a new series. We're doing Zoom and our great producer, John Naismith, is going to put it all together, but he's going to assemble an audience on Zoom and play it to them so it's a real audience reaction.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's never been a script. We're given advance notice of topics and various details, but there isn't a script as such. So if you hear us laughing, it's genuine because you don't know what each other was going to do and what you're going to say. And he edits it brilliantly. And 1972, so many years, we couldn't believe how long. When Humph died, we said, that's it. And as a year went by, but the BBC wanted us back and we went, not without him. Anyway, we agreed. We did three sessions of two shows, six recordings. Two with Stephen Fry as the chairman, two with Rob Brydon, who was bloody good. He did it when Humph went in the hospital. And two with this newish guy, Jack D, detached and sarcastic. He's the one. And that was it. And very early on, in Jack's era, we were at the Royal Theatre, Kingston, and in the middle of the recording, a man in the audience said very loudly, not the same without Humphrey Littleton, is it? Stunned silence. And Jack said, ah, dear Humph, wonder where he is now. I envy him. And he got applause, and we thought, that is style.
Yeah.
To defuse that moment brilliantly. Oh, Jack is good, and he laughs a lot, which you can't see on the radio.
Yeah. One of the greats we haven't mentioned, who you also worked with, was of course Spike Milligan, probably one of the great comic influences of the 1970s.
I did a show once, and I walked in the green room before, and Spike was lolling on a settee, and he jumped up and spread-eagled himself against the wall and said, Cryer's here, take my jokes, don't hurt me.
Did you, like Bob Monkhouse, have a great book full of jokes that you referred to all the time?
No, jottings. I've never been a good compiler, and not like Bob was, as you say. The old brain, which is now abysmal, always was in real life, names, but good with jokes. I used to jot down something that just occurred to me, you know, but people often ask me now, have I got any file? And of course, in the house move, a lot of stuff, you think, where did that go? And
yeah. In the bin, somewhere will come up with these long lost Barry Cryer scripts, and I'll be sending them for thousands and thousands of pounds.
John Lennon lyrics, scribbled on a bit of paper.
We haven't mentioned two other comedy greats who you would have come across, obviously, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
Oh, God. Well, I was reading just recently that the one-legged Tarzan sketch Peter wrote when he was 18. Alan Bennett, who's still a mate, we talk regularly on the phone because he just says, come on, joke. He always wants a joke. And Alan said, I read a quote from him recently, he said, oh, Cook, what do I do Beyond the Fringe? He said, we all have to think of something. And he had a bloody big bouquet of great jokes, and I sat there with my little orchid, the one thing I'd thought of. And Alan said about this lockdown, he said, my life hasn't changed. Spend most days sitting around at home, he said. Oh, and he goes for a ritual stroll with his partner Rupert every day in the local area, and he said, oh, people were clapping us, very touchy. And I found out they were clapping the NHS.
Well, Barry, thank you so much for being
our
guest.
Not at all. Pleasure.
Very kind of you.
And there we had to leave it. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to engage further with The Oldie Magazine, visit theoldie.co.uk. With editing by Michael Studiano, this has been a Gamekeeper production for The Oldie. Thank you for listening.